You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Let's start out with our motivation. And it's always good to contemplate the kindness of others. Because we're very habituated to thinking of their unkindness, how they're not giving us what we want. So, which leads to anger, disappointment, resentment. So it's good to think of the opposite, how kind they have been to us. In the same way, we can sometimes focus on how sentient beings have excluded us and we've been the ones who've been left out. And that, again, brings up anger and resentment, the wish to retaliate in us. But if we switch our perspective and look at all the times they have included us in various activities, then the external situation hasn't changed, but our internal perspective becomes more balanced. So instead of always seeing things through I'm excluded, we see things through I'm included. And it completely transforms our feeling about sentient beings. So I'll spend a moment contemplating that. Mind that feels close to sentient beings, and let's wish them well and make a commitment to act on that wish by not only benefiting people in this life but putting our energy into practice so that we will be more capable of benefiting them in future lives up until full awakening. So I was thinking about this thing of being excluded and being included because I often look at things as from the perspective of what I am excluded from. And of course then get very unhappy about it. And, you know, the old childhood mantra of it's not fair. Remember our childhood mantra? The first three words we ever learned after mom and dad. It's not fair. So, you know, because when we've been talking this week about Vinaya, we see there's some differences between monks and nuns. We see there's differences between the fully ordained and the novices. And, you know, we can very easily get into a mind that says, well, I'm being excluded, it's not fair. And then, of course, becoming quite unhappy and resentful. But we can look at the same situation and say, look how I am included. Yeah, look how I am able to take precepts. Look how I am able to do certain activities. And when we look at things in that way, then we feel completely different. And we feel like we're a part of the group. know, it even came up the other day when we were, you know, we'd talk about even our feelings in middle school and high school, you know, where everybody feels excluded. Yeah, remember? Yeah? There's the in-group of kids, and everybody likes them, and they're good-looking, and I'm not one of them, and it's not fair, because they're popular and I'm not. Remember middle school mentality? I was so convinced, you know, that I was the one who was excluded and didn't fit in. And then when later when I got older, I went back and I met some of the kids who were the socias, the popular ones. They also felt like they didn't fit in. I was shocked. What do you mean you thought you felt didn't fit in? You were the ones who set the standard. No, I was so insecure, I didn't fit in. Then I realized, wow, nobody in middle school and high school feels like they fit in. Yeah? And yet we create that mentality of I'm the only one. And then that, you know, influences us in an adverse way. Instead of like, well, this is just middle school mentality, high school mentality, what else is new? I'm actually included, I'm going to the school, I'm included. You know, I have my own group of friends. You know, they're not the important friends who are the jocks and the cheerleaders. Yeah, but the jocks and the cheerleaders don't feel like they fit in either. And I have my own group of friends, so I fit in with them. You know? So are you getting what I mean? So it's the whole glass half empty, glass half full thing. And since we love to feel like the world is against us, even though we're so miserable when we think like that, you know, we so often frame things in that way. And, you know, that's what the Dharma is trying to pull us out of, you know. Instead of framing things in that way, frame them in another way, which is just as accurate, if not more accurate. Yeah. So same thing, you know, ever since Freud, we're used to looking at our families. My parents did this, and they did that. And that's why I'm so messed up now. Instead of looking and seeing what our parents did do for us, you know, and appreciating it. And so it's the same kind of thing, you know, how we frame things, how we look at them. But it has a very strong impact on how we feel. So it's quite important to recognize, you know, these habitual patterns of, you know, I don't fit in, they're excluding me, it's unfair, they did or didn't do that for me when they should have or shouldn't have. And to really, you know, notice that and realize that's old habit and put it down and develop a new habit, a new way of looking. And this is the same as it is with everything. Now, sometimes we have old habits from when we were young about being anxious. You know, something happened when we were young, we responded to it with anxiety. We developed the habit of being anxious, and now everything that happens, we get anxious at. Yeah? Just because it's a habit to get anxious. You know, not because the situation calls for anxiety, but just because that's what we're in the habit of doing. Oh, there's something that isn't made up for certain? That's the cue for me to get anxious. Well, samsara is one uncertain condition. So that means we're going to be anxious all the time from here to awakening. What a prospect. Yeah? You want to be anxious from now until awakening? simply because that's a habit and that's what we're used to. And to not be anxious, we would feel completely disoriented, like, who am I? Yeah. So think about it and, you know, look at some of those habits and you know, see what they do to us and how it's, you know, quite possible to change them. You know, we need some determination, some perseverance to do it. But when we do that, you know, definitely our experience changes. Okay? So tonight, we're going to continue talking about emptiness and nirvana. Yeah. Now some people are going to go, emptiness, nirvana, it's hard. I'm not going to understand it. Already I know I'm not going to understand it. Because I never understand when they talk about emptiness. I never understand when they talk about nirvana. So this is going to be one of those teachings that I'm just going to have to sit here. And so I won't even try and listen because I know I won't understand. It's a good example of habitual thinking, isn't it? Okay, so go into that channel. Make yourself miserable. Make yourself not understand. Yeah. And if you get bored of that, maybe you can try focusing on the teaching and understanding something. Yeah. So even if not everything's 100% clear, just understanding a little bit is more than we understood before. Okay. So you remember last time? We were... we're on verse 38. Yeah. Well, it was 37 and 38. So 37 said, but the process of cyclic existence is not attained from itself, from something else, or from both, nor is it attained in the three times. So remember we went through that refutation, the tetralemma of things arising from self, other, both, and causally. Therefore, for one who knows this, the eye grasping ceases, and hence also karma and birth. Okay, so when we can see that samsara is not inherently existent, yeah, then we begin to see that it is dependent arising. Okay, so for someone who sees emptiness of inherent existence and dependent arising, then, you know, the eye grasping ceases, and with that, then affliction ceases, karma ceases, rebirth and samsara ceases. Okay? And then verse 38, seeing in this fashion the arising of effect from cause, and seeing its cessation, the wise think the world is ultimately neither existent nor non-existent. So when it talks existent and non-existent, it has different meanings in different situations. Here you have to add some words. The world, meaning samsara, is neither inherently existent nor totally non-existent. Okay? In other words, it is empty of inherent existence and it exists dependently. Okay. So by understanding dependent arising, yeah, we come to know emptiness. Yeah, and that wisdom of emptiness enhances our understanding of dependent arising. That wisdom also counteracts the ignorance, which is the first of the 12 links. And when ignorance ceases, karma formation ceases. Yeah, all the karma created under the influence of ignorance. So the polluted karma ceases, so the birth propelled by them ceases. Okay? So then verse 39 says, having listened to this dharma that puts an end to dukkha, The undiscerning, afraid of the fearless state, are terrified because they do not understand. Okay? So some sentient beings, having listened to this Dharma of how things are not produced by self, other, both, or causelessly, how things are not produced inherently in the three times, how things exist even though they're empty, how they exist dependently. So some people hear that teaching, and that teaching is the teaching that puts an end to suffering, like I just explained how that process works of counteracting samsara. But because they misunderstand and they have very strong grasping at true existence, they become afraid of the fearless state. Yeah. So the fearless state is nirvana. They become afraid of nirvana. Okay. It's like the person who's in prison who is afraid of getting out of prison. Yeah? So afraid of the fearless state. And why are they afraid? Because they think things inherently exist. When they hear about emptiness, they misunderstand and think that because things are empty, they are totally non-existent. So then they think that the I ceases at nirvana, you know, and then nirvana becomes like death. There's I to completely cease, and like they become terrified of it. Okay? So they're terrified due to their own lack of understanding. So we're going to get into that some more in the upcoming verses. Okay? So how people hear emptiness and they misunderstand and develop aversion to emptiness. Oh no, emptiness means that I'm not going to exist at all. That nothing exists. You know, and that's the kind of fear that can come up sometimes at the time of death when we're losing our body, we're losing our whole ego identity. You know, the fear of non-existing. But this even comes up for these people even before they die. So it's really a problem. Okay? So then verse 40 says, yeah, Nagarjuna is talking to them, and he says, you are not afraid about the claim that all this will not exist in nirvana. Why then are you afraid when told here that the three phases of samsara do not exist? Okay? So, yeah, not only the non-Buddhists are afraid of emptiness due to misunderstanding, but so are some of the Buddhist schools. Okay? So according to the Vaibhasikas and the Satantrikas, they think that at the time someone eliminates the afflictive obscurations and becomes an arhat, they obtain what they call nirvana with remainder. Okay? And remainder here means the remainder of this body, which was the body that they were born with, and this body, because they were born still in samsara, this body is a samsaric body that is polluted. So they still, even though these arhats have attained nirvana and will not be reborn, they still have, while they're still alive, they still have the remainder of this polluted body. Okay, so they call it nirvana with remainder. Okay, and then they think that when they die, when the arhat dies, yeah, then and leaves this body, then this old body is gone, and they call that nirvana without remainder. And it's not only the physical aggregate, you know, that they abandon at the time of nirvana without remainder, but they think that also all their mental aggregates, feeling, discrimination, volitional factors, and consciousness, that all that ceases as well. So they say then, at nirvana without remainder, yeah, all the aggregates have ceased, so the person also ceases. Yeah. So you'll find, if you go to Thailand, some people think like this. Not everybody, but some people think like this. And, you know, you become an arhat, you have nirvana with remainder, because you have this body. When you die, you leave this body, and the continuity of your consciousness ceases, because there's no longer any afflictions to feed it into rebirth, and this body ceases, so then you have nirvana without remainder, you know, and the person ceases. Okay, so that's how they think. Yeah. Now, the prasangikas don't think like that. They have a very different viewpoint. Okay? So, let's go back to the Vaibhasikas and the Satantrikas. When they say that, you know, they also say for the Buddha, you know, because he was born, he was still an ordinary being, so he still had a flesh and blood polluted body, attained awakening, had nirvana with remainder, went into peri-nirvana, and then the continuity of the Buddha ceases at that point. So they, because of that belief, they don't understand when the Mahayana schools talk about the four Buddha kayas, okay, the four Buddha bodies. And here body doesn't mean physical body, it means like a corpus or a body of qualities, okay? So, yeah, they don't understand that at all. So the Mahayana school say actually, you know, the previous continuity of Shakyamuni, Buddha, was actually enlightened a long time ago, and what we saw on our earth was an emanation body of the different kayas. It was an emanation body that appeared in the aspect of an ordinary being. Yeah, because it was a way to teach us. Because if you know, the Buddha appeared as an ordinary being, he had to go through the whole process of renunciation. He practiced very hard. He endured all these difficulties. And then he attained enlightenment. His whole life becomes a teaching. You know, this, we spent the beginning part of EML on this. Yeah, his whole life is a teaching to us on how to practice. So, you know, from the Mahayana viewpoint, already a Buddha, but appeared like that for our benefit in order to teach us. Okay? But in actual fact, you know, he had attained the four Buddha kayas, the four Buddha bodies. Those four can be condensed into three. They can also be condensed into two. When they're condensed into two, we have the Dharmakaya, or the truth body, and the Rupakaya, or the form body. Okay? So the Dharmakaya, when it's subdivided into two, we have the wisdom Dharmakaya, that is the omniscient mind of the Buddha that knows all phenomena, and we also have the nature Dharmakaya, which is the emptiness of a Buddha's mind and the true cessations of on a Buddha's, you know, of the Buddha's mind. And those we sentient beings cannot access directly. They're far beyond our ability to understand. So therefore, the Buddha appears in form bodies to communicate with us. So there's two kinds of form bodies. One is the enjoyment body, which is the form the Buddha appears in the Pure Lands to teach the Arya Bodhisattvas, and then the emanation body, which is the form he appears in to teach ordinary sentient beings. There's different kinds of emanation bodies. The one that Shakyamuni Buddha appeared as is called the supreme emanation body, because it's when the Buddha appears as a wheel-turning Buddha. In other words, there's no Dharma in the world at that time, and so he's the one who starts turning the Dharma wheel and introduces the sasana, the Buddhist doctrine. Okay, but the lower schools, because of their view of, because they think things inherently exist, and because of the way that they think about nirvana, then they don't assert these four Buddha bodies, and they have a very different idea of what happens at nirvana. Okay, so they're kind of, when they say that everything ceases, it can be a little bit nihilistic. They don't see it as nihilistic. Yeah, but we might see it as kind of nihilistic. Like, what do you mean? You work that hard to become a Buddha and then everything ceases? Yeah? And how is that possible? Yeah. So, from the Mahayana viewpoint, the continuity of clarity and awareness, the continuity of mind, there's nothing that can cause it to cease. One moment of mind produces the next moment, whether it's polluted or unpolluted, whether there's affliction present or not, still there's a continuity of clarity and awareness. So that's why we say that even after the Buddha, became a Buddha, then there was still the continuity of consciousness that became the Dharmakaya. Yeah. And the continuity of the extremely subtle body, which became the Rupakaya. Yeah. The form body. Okay? So then the Vaibhasikas, they say that everything's truly existent. Because if things didn't truly exist, then they wouldn't exist at all. We've heard that framework, that reframe before. So when the prasangikas negate the conceived object of true grasping, when the conceived object of true grasping is, true existence or inherent existence, when the prasangikas negate that, then for the Vaibhasikas and the Satantrikas, that means that when arhats attain liberation, they will become non-existent. And that terrifies them. So the Prasangikas respond saying, but you already say that at the time of nirvana with remainder, the aggregates are destroyed. Yeah. So why are you afraid when we say that the aggregates aren't truly existent? Okay, so it doesn't make any sense. Why are you afraid when we explain that the self-grasping ignorance, the polluted karma produced by it, and birth are extinguished? Why are you afraid when we say that none of those things were inherently existent to start with, but on the other hand, you aren't afraid of the nirvana, the way you assert it, where the person becomes non-existent. Okay? So, So in other words, since you say, here's the Prasangikas talking to them, since you say that the person and the aggregates, which are inherently existent, cease at the time of nirvana without remainder, because they're thinking that the aggregates, are inherently existent, and then they cease totally at the time of nirvana without remainder. Yeah, since you think that, why are you frightened when we prasangikas say there is no inherently existent person or aggregates at that time? Yeah. As far as you're concerned, we're saying the same thing. Yeah. There's no inherently existent aggregates. And you're saying there's no aggregates. It boils down to the same thing. Okay? Because they say the aggregates are inherently existent. So when they say the aggregates, you know, aren't present, then it's saying there's no inherently existent aggregate. So it's the same thing. So why are you guys so afraid of emptiness? Yeah, doesn't make sense. Okay, so verse 41. In liberation, there is neither self nor aggregates. If you are intent upon that kind of liberation, why aren't you pleased with the teaching that refutes self and aggregates here as well? Okay? So it's the same thing that we just said. Okay? But here, the commentary goes into this more detail about nirvana. Yeah, so the Prasangikas explain to the Vaibhasikas, why do you object when we say there's no inherently existent person or aggregates at the time of nirvana? Your own Vaibhasika system asserts that at that time, at the time liberation is attained, the self and aggregates become completely non-existent and extinguished. If there are no self and aggregates, there also aren't any inherently existent self and aggregates. Okay, do you get the reason? If there's no aggregates, then there's no truly existent aggregates. There's no, you know, it's like if there's no pot, there's no purple pot, no brown pot, no full pot, no empty pot. Yeah, so it's the same kind of thing. So if there are no aggregates, no self and no aggregates, there also aren't any inherently existent self or aggregates. And then the Vaibhasikas respond, we are not afraid of our version of nirvana because liberation that is completely free of suffering exists inherently. So why aren't we afraid of the aggregates and self ceasing at the time of liberation? Because liberation, nirvana, exists inherently. So you see the clinging that these schools have? Everything exists inherently. Because if nirvana didn't exist from its own side, independent of everything else, then it wouldn't exist at all. Okay? Same way of thinking about the person. If the person's empty of inherent existence, then it doesn't exist at all. So it's the same misunderstanding that they have in both cases. So now the Prasangikas say to the Vaibhasikas, I love the way Geshe Loeb writes this whole dialogue that they're having. Okay. If liberation existed inherently, it would have to be either an inherently existent person or an inherently existent phenomena. Okay, because there's only those two choices if something exists inherently. But when arhats attain nirvana, the self-grasping of persons and the self-grasping of phenomena have been completely extinguished by the power of the wisdom realizing emptiness. Yeah. So the objects of the, because those two self-graspings have been extinguished and no longer exist, then the objects of those two self-graspings, an inherently existent person and an inherently existent person, have also been eliminated because the meditator has realized they are non-existent. So for that reason, nirvana cannot be inherently existent. Okay. So what's going on here is, you know, the Prasangikas are saying, okay, so if nirvana is truly existent, has to be truly existent person, truly existent phenomena. However, you know, the self-grasping of a truly existent person, self-grasping of truly existent phenomena, have both been eliminated at the time of nirvana. So clearly, if they've been eliminated, the objects that they're grasping at, which actually never existed to start with, but it's also been eliminated, so therefore nirvana can't be truly existent because there's nothing that's truly existent. Okay? So to express this in another way, if liberation existed inherently, it would have to be either a self of per- person or a self of phenomena. There's no third option. Yeah. While the Vaisakas may say this is not a problem because they assert a self of phenomena, remember? Yeah. Their position would still accrue all the faults of asserting inherent existence that the Prasangikas have refuted in the previous verses. And will continue to refute. Okay? So this section here, I think, is one of the most difficult ones. So, yeah, let focus and take what you can. So the Vaibhasikas and the Satantrikas assert that nirvana is the elimination of the afflictions and the polluted aggregates which existed inherently. Yeah? So, you know, the Prasangikas also say nirvana is the cessation of the polluted aggregates, but they never inherently existed to start with. You know, the Vaibhasikas say they inherently existed. So the Prasangikas respond and say if the aggregates and the afflictions existed inherently before nirvana, then nirvana could never be attained because things that exist inherently can never change and never be destroyed. Why? Because inherent existence is the same as independent existence. Independent existence means something does not depend on anything else whatsoever. And something that doesn't depend on anything else can never cease. And it can never arise because it can't be affected by anything else. So it can't be affected by causes and conditions, can't cease, it can't arise. So then, you know, the afflictions can never be eliminated, and nirvana can never be attained if all these things existed inherently to start with. Okay? In addition, nirvana is not the elimination of inherently existent afflictions and aggregates. Okay? The realization of emptiness does not make something that was previously inherently existent now empty of inherent existence. Okay? So nirvana is not the elimination of inherently existent aggregates. Why? Why not? Because inherently existent aggregates never existed to start with. So the realization of emptiness does not say the aggregates were once inherently existent, like the Vaibhasikas and Satantrikas believe, and you realize emptiness, and then they become empty of true existence. It's not like that. The empty of true existence is their nature from the get-go. Yeah. So realizing emptiness does not destroy true existence or inherent existence. It destroys the grasping at these things. Because the conceived object, the apprehended object, that these two misconceptions, these two graspings hold on to, yeah, are true existence, inherent existence, and they never existed before. They never existed at all whatsoever. So realizing emptiness doesn't make things that used to be inherently existent now empty of inherent existence. Okay, they've always been empty. Furthermore, the Vaibhasikas and Satantrikas assert that at the time of nirvana without remainder, the aggregates no longer exist. Okay? Prasangikas disagree because if this were so, then at the time of this final nirvana, there would be nobody who attained nirvana. This would be so because if the aggregates no longer existed, if the aggregates were destroyed, there would be no basis of designation upon which to designate the self. And so then the self, the person, would not exist. And then there would be nobody who attained nirvana. So here you see that the Mahayana schools say, you know, the aggregates are not ceased at the time of nirvana. The polluted aggregates cease, but there's a continuity of pure aggregates that go on, okay? Or we can say unpolluted aggregates. Yeah, not, they're not totally pure, so better to say unpolluted aggregates. Okay, so contrarily, when the polluted aggregates exist, when the polluted aggregates exist, and thus the person exists, there would be no nirvana, because according to the Vaibhasikas and Sotantrikas, nirvana is the cessation of the aggregates, of the polluted aggregates. Okay. So either way, the tenets of these lower systems face many contradictions. Yeah. So it's either before you attain nirvana, there's the presence of the aggregates, so there's the presence of the person, but the aggregates are polluted, so there's no nirvana. Then after you attain nirvana, the aggregates are non-existent, so then there's no person, so then there's nobody who attained nirvana. Okay? These kind of debates that go on. So in Prasangika say that in nirvana, the self and aggregates are eliminated. Okay, when they say the self and aggregates are eliminated, it doesn't mean that they become non-existent. It means that the self-grasping of person and the self-grasping of the aggregates are extinguished. Okay? So thus, inherently existent afflictions, aggregates, and self, and none of these existed, these inherently existent afflictions, aggregates, and self, which never existed, they are eliminated at the time of nirvana in the sense that they are no longer apprehended. Yeah. So at the time that, you know, the arhats actualize, you know, nirvana, only emptiness appears to the mind. There is no remainder of the appearance of inherent existence. So in this way, the Prasangikas lead us to see that nirvana and emptiness are not separate. Okay. So what we're getting at here, is when Aryas, and this applies to Aryas in general, but they don't have to be arhats, but when Aryas are in meditative equipoise and emptiness, there's no self-grasping, you know, manifest, at that time, either of persons or of aggregates, and there's no appearance of true existence or inherent existence at that time. Yeah? So the Prasangikas define nirvana with and without remainder differently. Instead of saying the remainder is the aggregates, they say the remainder is the appearance of true existence. So for arhats, or aryas in general, when they're having involved in meditative equipoise that directly sees emptiness, there is no appearance of truly existent things. Yeah? So that is called the nirvana without remainder, because there's no remainder of true existence. When the arhats and aryas who aren't yet Buddhas, when they arise from their meditation on emptiness, they still have the appearance of true existence. So that's called nirvana with a remainder, because at that time they have the appearance of true existence. Okay? So the Prasangikas have a totally different way of defining nirvana with and without remainder than the other schools do. Okay? Verse 42. Nirvana is not even a non-thing, so how could it be a thing? Nirvana is said to be the cessation of the notions of things and non-things. So when we say thing, we mean something that's impermanent, that's conditioned. Non-thing means something that is permanent and unconditioned. Okay? So nirvana cannot be an inherently existent thing because it's not inherently existent and it's also not a thing. Yeah? Okay. So, but the Vibhasakas, they say nirvana is a thing. Yeah? They say that nirvana is like a dam that halts the movement of water. So it functions, nirvana functions to stop the continuation of afflictions and birth in cyclic existence. This is what the Vaivasikas say. However, if nirvana were a thing, it would be impermanent, which would mean it would age and cease, in which case it would not be the unchanging, unconditioned, lasting peace that nirvana is supposed to be. Okay, so they refute the Vaibhasikas saying that nirvana is a thing. Okay, the Sotantrikas say that nirvana is the cessation of afflictions and samsaric rebirth, and that also it inherently exists. So that's kind of like saying it's an inherently existent non-thing. Yeah. But if nirvana were inherently existent, again, it would have to either be a self of persons or a self of phenomena, but it's neither of those because neither of them ever existed. Okay? And also, neither self-grasping of persons nor self-grasping of phenomena exists at the time of liberation. And so those two selves that are grasped at, which never exist, the two graspings that apprehend them, all of that does not exist, okay? And wisdom realizes them as non-existent. Okay? So some people say nirvana is a mere destruction or disintegration of the afflictions. Okay? So according to the Prasangikas, if that were the case, nirvana would then be impermanent because Prasangikas assert that the destruction of death or the destruction or death of someone or something has to be a thing. It's a having ceased. It's a jigpa. Remember jigpas? Okay, so is nirvana a jigpa? Is it a having ceased? No, because if it were a having ceased, it would be an affirming negative that could produce a result. Okay? Yeah? And then it would be impermanent, then it would age and cease, and that would be a big problem. Okay? So, nirvana is permanent, it's a non-affirming negative, it's a mere absence that doesn't apply anything in its stead. So it's not a thing. Okay. So since nirvana is not an inherently existent thing, it cannot be an inherently existent non-thing either. And the reason for that is because a non-thing is posited in relationship to thing. Okay? And inherently existent phenomena must be totally independent and unrelated to all other factors, so they aren't posited in terms of any other factors. Okay, so if it's not a thing, it can't be a non-thing, because that would make thing and non-thing are mutually dependent, something that's inherently existent cannot depend on anything. It's not mutually dependent at all. Okay. Then, nirvana is also posited from the viewpoint of the extinction of the apprehension of things and non-things as inherently existent. Remember that was the last line in the verse? Yeah, nirvana is said to be the cessation of the notions of things and non-things. So now he's going to explain what that means. Okay, so nirvana is also posited from the viewpoint of the extinction of the apprehension of things and non-things as inherently existent. Okay, so there's two purities that we have. This is according to the Prasangikas. Okay. So according to the Prasangikas, there are, actually I should say Madhyamakas. Okay, so there's two purities. So one is the natural purity, which is the emptiness of inherent existence. And that has always been present. Yeah. When we talk about the naturally abiding Buddha nature, it's the emptiness of inherent existence of the mind. And that's always been present. That's never been created. It can never be destroyed. Okay. Then there's also the purity of adventitious stains, yeah, which is brought about through the wisdom realizing emptiness. So adventitious means like temporary. Yeah, so the temporary stains like ignorance, all the afflictions, all those kinds of things, they're temporary. They're not embedded in the nature of the mind. So ordinary beings have the natural purity in that their minds by nature are empty of inherent existence. So while ordinary beings have no stains of inherent existence, and they also don't have any inherently existent stains, yeah, they don't have the extinction of the afflictions and karma, and thus they don't have the purity of those adventitious stains. Okay? So in nirvana, there are neither inherent stains nor adventitious stains. Yeah. There's no inherent stains because there never were. That's the natural purity of the mind. There's no adventitious stains because they've been eliminated due to the wisdom realizing emptiness. So in nirvana there is simply emptiness. So thus, true cessation, nirvana, liberation, and peace are all emptiness. So this is a big topic of debate in the monasteries. Like, you know, is nirvana emptiness or is it not emptiness? Because if nirvana is the elimination of the afflictions, then it's the non-existence of something that used to exist. But if nirvana is emptiness, emptiness is the non-existence of inherent existence, which never existed. So, you know, is nirvana what's the elimination of anyway? And what is going on here? And if it's an elimination of ignorance, anger, and attachment, is it a shikpa? Yeah? Then you say nirvana is impermanent, but then how can it be the lasting bliss? You know? Because things that are impermanent are going to disintegrate. Okay, so I think this is quite sharp here. When it is said that nirvana is the extinction of afflictions, it not only means that afflictions, which in this case is what the word things means in the verse, you know, it not only means that afflictions, i.e. things, have been extinguished, but also that there are no inherently existent afflictions. And if and inherently existent afflictions would be non-things in nirvana. Okay? This absence of inherently existent afflictions is emptiness and ultimate truth. Okay? So according to most prasangikas, true cessation is emptiness because the stains are extinguished within the sphere of reality, within the sphere of emptiness. Yeah. Thus it is posited from the viewpoint of the emptiness of inherent stains. So sometimes they talk about afflictions being extinguished by emptiness, and sometimes afflictions being extinguished in emptiness. Depends how you read a certain phrase in Sanskrit grammar. If you read it as, you know, nirvana is the afflictions being extinguished by emptiness, it means that by wisdom realizing emptiness, that wisdom being applied and meditated on again and again, that eliminates the afflictions. Okay, so we've done that. Yeah, we've talked about that before. When you say the afflictions are eliminated within emptiness, then you're saying the afflictions have been empty to start with. So there's been no inherently existent afflictions, no inherently existent emptiness, no inherently existent nirvana or samsara to start with. So when you realize emptiness, when your mind is abiding within that realization, then any inherently existent thing has been extinguished. In that, wisdom has realized it doesn't exist. Okay? It gets easier now. These were the verses that I was going crazy over before. So I hope they're right. So for verse 43 and 44. In brief, a nihilistic view is the belief that karma has no effects. It is non-meritorious and leads to lower rebirth. It is said to be a wrong view. In brief, a realistic view is the belief that karma has an effect. It is meritorious and leads to higher rebirth. It is said that it is a right view. Okay? So, these verses follow up on the Vaivasika and Satantrika's objection that if nirvana is not inherently existent, it must be totally non-existent. And to this, the prasangikas respond, the nihilistic extreme, yeah, because the Vaivasikas are saying that the prasangikas are nihilistic, because they assert emptiness. So the prasangikas say the nihilistic extreme is believing that the four truths of the Aryas, the three jewels, the law of karma and its effects, and so on, are non-existent. That's what the nihilistic view is. Yeah. Not saying that nirvana isn't inherently existent. But as a result of adhering to this non-meritorious view that says all these things are non-existent, a person will be reborn in the lower realms. So saying that these same things are not inherently existent is not the extreme of non-existence. Yeah, the extreme of non-existence is saying that these things, that karma, three jewels, and all these things don't exist whatsoever. So the point is there's a huge difference between not existing inherently and not existing in general. That's the point of it. Okay? On the other hand, a realistic view believes that the four truths, the three jewels, karma and its effects, while not existing inherently, exist conventionally. Since they exist conventionally, it is possible to engage in abandoning what is to be abandoned and practicing what is to be adopted on the path. Thinking, for example, that karma and its results exist is meritorious and leads to higher rebirth. And as explained in the sutras, this is the worldly right view. Okay? So the whole thing is that the Vaivasikas and Sotantrikas are saying, you Prasangikas are nihilistic because you say that, you know, the person and the aggregates and nirvana don't inherently exist, so you're saying they don't exist at all. So that's the nihilistic extreme. And the Prasangikas are coming back and saying, no, we're not nihilistic. Nihilistic is when you say that the three jewels and karma and effects and the four truths of the Aryas, you know, when these things don't exist. That's the nihilistic extreme. So saying things don't exist inherently is not nihilistic. Saying they don't exist at all is nihilistic. Okay, got it? Okay. So, do you have questions? Or should I do another verse? Yeah?
So, when you talk about nirvana, it's not the same as full awakening, right?
Well, it's a little bit unclear here sometimes when they're talking about, because nirvana sometimes, when we talk about nirvana and full awakening, yeah, they are different. But when we talk about non-abiding nirvana is full awakening. Okay? Because non-abiding nirvana means that you have eliminated the affliction, so you don't abide in samsara. But you're also not choosing to remain in your own personal state of nirvana, yeah, that the arhats have. So you're not abiding in the extreme of nirvana either. So that's why they call it the awakening of a Buddha non-abiding nirvana.
Non-abiding nirvana is full.
Yeah.
Concerned about confused now about the naming, because when did Prasangikas become that as opposed to Madhyamaka? Like, so Nagarjuna was what, and then the commentator here, okay. I guess Khyentse Tekchak, of course, was a Prasangika.
Yeah. So at the time of Nagarjuna, the term Prasangika, Svatantrika did not exist. Those terms, I mean, talking about the types of reasoning existed, but seeing that as a school did not exist. So the term Prasangika is being retrospectively imputed on Nagarjuna, you know,
okay,
by the later people to say that, you know, Nagarjuna was not a Svatantrika. He did not assert inherent existence conventionally. Okay? Yeah, maybe that needs to be clarified here. Yeah?
I want to ask a question first.
Okay.
Within the Prasangika view, is not abiding nirvana the same as nirvana without remainder?
Nirvana without remainder can be possessed by an arhat, you know, or an Arya when they're in deep meditative equipoise, because they don't have the appearance of true existence. Yeah? So that's different than non-abiding nirvana, which is only full awakening. Okay?
Okay, so I was just thinking about the eye grasping that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of weeks back in July, we talked about an innate eye grasping and an acquired eye grasping.
Yeah.
So What's an example of an acquired eye grasping?
Okay, so the innate eye grasping, the acquired eye grasping. An example of the innate eye grasping is you go to listen to somebody, some spiritual teacher, who says things are inherently existent. Yeah? There's a soul. There's a person. There's something that's the essence of you that God created. That view is acquired eye grasping because somebody taught it to you and they gave reasons, you know? So the reason, yes, there's a God and God created you and you have a soul and, you know, so there's lots of reasoning and explanation.
So it could also include the lower schools?
Yeah.
As acquired.
As acquired. The innate eye grasping is, it goes from one life to the other. Nobody teaches it to you. There's absolutely no reasoning behind it. It's just the instinct of... Well, they say it's conceptual, but the word conceptual means many, many different things, okay? We usually think of conceptual as gross concepts. I'm thinking about a pumpkin, and an image of pumpkin is arising in my mind. That's what we think of when we think of conceptual, okay? That isn't the meaning of conceptual. When Jeffrey, for example, calls it the conception of true existence. And that's the reason why I translate that term as grasping in true existence instead of the conception of true existence. Because when you say the conception, we get the idea, oh, you're thinking something is truly existent. But it's not that gross. It's this innate, you know, like that. This is the way things exist. They have an essence. It's not a mind of direct perception. So because it's not a mind of direct perception, it's conceptual.
So then when you think about this in terms of the afflicted obscurations and the cognitive obscurations, mm-hmm. then how does it split out? Are the cognitive obscurations conceptual?
Are they conceptual? They, no, I don't think they would say that. Yeah, because the cognitive obscurations are not consciousness. Let me make sure of that. Yeah, it's a false appearance. It's the appearance of true existence. No, wait a minute. Let me take that back. I need to think about it a little bit more. But the afflictions, you know, have all been eliminated. Yeah. And so they're gone. Yeah. You have the cognitive obscurations, which are the latencies of the afflictions. Yeah. So the latencies of the afflictions are not minds. Yeah. They're abstract composites. They're not consciousness. But the latencies of the afflictions produce this appearance or perception of true existence. And that I have to think about, whether that would be considered a mind or not.
But a Buddha doesn't have any appearance of inherent existence.
Not to a Buddha themselves. But because Buddhas know everything that exists, and the appearance of inherent existence exists in the minds of ordinary beings, because therefore the Buddha, through knowing what happens in ordinary beings' minds, knows what the appearance of inherent existence looks like. Okay, so inherent existence does not exist. The appearance of inherent existence does exist.
Okay. So, I don't understand. Did you say that there was a continuity of consciousness even after Nirvana?
Yeah.
So, How does that tie in with, like, so beginningless, so is it beginningless and endless? Is it basically
okay, endless? So what the consciousness, being just clarity and awareness, is beginning and endless. Yeah, the afflictions are beginningless, but they have an end. So the afflictions, if you have this stream of consciousness going, the afflictions are like an overlay, something put in on top of it. Yeah, it's like a leaf in the river. You can take the leaf out, the river continues. So like that.
So there was no first cause for afflictions, but there's a last cause for afflictions.
There's no first cause of afflictions, but there is an end to afflictions, because there's something that can eliminate them. There exists an antidote that can eliminate the afflictions. But there's no antidote that can stop the stream of consciousness. Okay? So that's why sometimes, you know, they say that, there's the cloud, there's the sky and the clouds. So the sky is the consciousness and the clouds are the afflictions. Yeah. So the afflictions are said to be adventitious, but they're temporary. Yeah?
It just makes me wonder how they could sell this goal of, you know, everything ceasing and how that could be so, you know, compared to full awakening. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so how would you sell that? Now, it's interesting because, you know, to us sometimes, yeah, like, how do they? But if you meet people who follow that tradition, that's really sincerely what they want. You know, it's like samsara is just awful, it's horrible, we got to get out as soon as possible. You know, I can't stay in 1 second longer. And the Bodhisattva vehicle, they talk about, you know, you take birth in samsara again. I don't want any of that, you know. I just want to get out and things cease, and then I'm liberated, my suffering has stopped. Yeah. And for some people, that really makes fantastic sense, and that's what they want. Yeah. Of course, that's not really what really happens. Yeah. I mean, the Prasangika say, yeah, you eliminate all the afflictions, then you stay in your meditation on emptiness that's very blissful until the Buddha wakes you up and says, you know, there's all the sentient beings. Yeah. So that's why, the Majjhimaka say there's one final vehicle. Everybody must become a Buddha. Whereas these other schools say there's three final vehicles. Once you become a hero arhat, that's it. Consciousness stops, never go on to become a Buddha. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Just want to clarify the definition of a non-thing that's permanent and unconditioned.
Yes.
But nirvana is not a non-thing. Or is it that nirvana is not an inherently existent?
It's not an inherently existent non-thing.
Two more, sorry. So if the Buddha and the emanation, the supreme emanation, body, mm-hmm. is a Dharmakaya?
No, the Dharmakaya is the Buddhist mind. The supreme emanation body is one of the four bodies.
So as the historical Shakyamuni appeared in the supreme emanation, you said it was the time, the turning of the Dharma, when there was no Dharma. Is that the only time a supreme emanation appears?
Yeah, but remember that there's countless world systems and there's countless universes and they've all existed, you know, I mean the whole, all of existence has been beginningless. So there's been many supreme emanation bodies in the past in different world systems. But they all appear in that world system when there's no Dharma that's being publicly taught.
And the Buddha wouldn't appear as a supreme emanation for any other reason?
not as a supreme emanation body. There are other emanation bodies that the Buddha appears in. Because like we say, there's lots of Buddhas, and you know, there could be, we could know emanation bodies of the Buddhas. Yeah, they look like ordinary human beings. They manifest to benefit sentient beings, but they don't wear the name tag saying, "Hi, I'm an emanation body of the Buddha."
And we don't have the purity of mind to recognize them either, right?
Huh?
We don't have the purity of mind.
Yeah, we don't have the ability to recognize them at all.
I just have a question about the biological sutta. How do you die?
They don't say everything's permanent.
No, I'm sorry. When things are inherently existent.
Yeah. Then you know, you die and your consciousness gets reborn. Mm-hmm. You know, and you have an inherently existent consciousness. Because they would say if your consciousness weren't inherently existent, then when you die it would cease altogether. So, you know, because that's the thing. They use dependent arising to prove inherent existence, whereas the Madhyamakas use it to prove emptiness. Yeah. So they would just say, yeah, you die and your mind stream continues on, and your mind stream's inherently existent. Yeah. And the person is, you know, well, many of them would say, not all of them, but the person is the mind stream.
Mm-hmm. How does the Buddha decide when to wake up a being from personal karma, since that being no longer has karma ripening?
Say that, how does a Buddha
decide when to wake up a being from personal nirvana?
A Buddha doesn't decide anything. Buddha's actions are totally spontaneous. Yeah. And don't ask me how a Buddha does it. Because I don't understand how a Buddha is, because I don't even understand my own mind. Okay? But the Buddha acts spontaneously, so. Buddha doesn't say, this morning, April, whatever it is, you know, August, whatever it is, let's see, which arhats am I going to wake up? You know? Maybe I'll send Maitri and Karuna, you know, to paw their face. You know, like they do, you know, like they do to us when we wake up at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. Maitri's going like this, wake up, wake up. You know. No, it's not like that.
Sometimes you have examples from masters, like the Yogyan Samaboshi, who was many years in retreat, and then his teacher asked him to come out, or other teachers, you know, and who knows what kind of level of realization their teacher had, to be able to discern, to decide this is not enough.
Yeah, but being in retreat is different than being enlightened.
Right.
Yeah. If they had some realizations during retreat.
Yeah, then their teacher may say, now it's time to come out and teach.
Yeah,
sure. Why not? His Holiness did that with one of my teachers who just wanted to stay in retreat, and His Holiness said, come out of retreat and go to Italy. Yes?
And I went through this with Ari David too, and now it's back. It's like in this refutation between the Madhyamakas and the Satantrikas and the Vaibhashikas, you have to, the Madhyamakas have to get them to accept that true existence is independent existence and nothing changes, because they don't hold that.
Right.
But all the arguments from the Madhyamaka side are totally based on that definition. So how in the world do you actually refute somebody who's
well,
never
because,
done it?
Because actually those people do hold that they say the person's impermanent. They say the aggregates are impermanent. So then they throw the consequence. You know, the person is permanent because it's inherently existent.
Oh, okay.
And then that contradicts, what do you mean the person's permanent because it's inherently existent? Yeah?
Uh-huh.
So then, you know, if their sharp faculty then they start to think about that. If they're dull faculty, it doesn't mean anything to them.
Yeah, and they're not going to get with you anyway.
Hmm?
And they're not going to change
anymore. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they say all these things are impermanent. And Yama say, but how can you say they're impermanent and truly existent at the same time? Because if things were truly existent, they would be permanent. And it's very clear, even you yourself say that they're impermanent. Okay? Yeah?
I've heard that the Mahayana heart is a Buddha.
Yeah.
So how does, so what they are referring to an heart discussion is the lower school heart?
Usually when we say arhat, we're talking about somebody who's attained liberation. When we say Mahayana arhat, then we're talking about the Buddha.
Isn't that very confusing?
No, it's like, talking about a person and a Singaporean who's a person, or something like that. Yeah, there can be different kinds of arhats, like there can be different kinds of people. Yeah, the term, words are flexible. Yeah, the term arhat, you can put it on somebody who's, because when we chant the praise to the Buddha in the every morning, we call them an arhat. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that means when an Arya Bodhisattva attains the eighth bhumi, it doesn't change his name. He's still an Arya Bodhisattva.
Yeah, but he's also an arhat at that time.
So he is an arhat.
Yeah.
But he's not considered a Mahayana arhat.
Gee, I don't know.
Okay.
Sorry. I don't know. Get a dictionary. I don't know if he's called a Mahayana arhat at the eighth bhumi. Sorry. So, yeah? Oh, let's dedicate. Remember I said saying I don't know once in a while is okay, but not too many times. So don't ask me anything I don't know.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Gosvami's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Idam
Gura Namandala Kandirya Tayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West. Lord.